The San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy, independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 25, Episode 20, Atlanticism versus Eurasianism Redux, When Worlds Collide, talking with Alp Sevimlisoy. He joins us from his office in Istanbul, Turkey. Good morning, Alp, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Jim. It's a pleasure to be back. Last time we spoke, I was heading off to Carmel. It's been a while since I've come back, and I can tell you that seeing as we're talking about Atlanticism versus Eurasianism, if the end of the world is nigh, then I'll be at the lodge at Pebble Beach.
Okay. By way of introduction, of course, you've been on the show before, but of course, Alp is a noted geopolitical strategist who focuses on NATO in the Mediterranean. He works with governments and corporations seeking to navigate their way through the shifting sands of global politics. He heads up his own defense management company, working with countries throughout the region with regard to building their defense capabilities. He is also a widely published commentator in Newsweek, The Daily Mail, The Daily Express, Politico, among other publications. Alp, please take a moment to define Atlanticism versus Eurasianism for our listeners.
Jim, Atlanticism is best described by Pax Americana, the concept of American peace that we've been living under for very much near a century now. And when we juxtapose it to the Roman Empire, the closest thing that comes to Augustus's reign is the period from the Marshall Plan onwards to what we have today. And when we look at Atlanticism, when we dissect it, it's very much to do with being a liberal democracy with a capital L. It's very much to do with a way of life. And this way of life is a constant for us, whether we're living in Istanbul, whether we're living in New York, whether we're living in Carmel, whether we're living in Paris. This way of life is secured by NATO and by de facto via our nuclear umbrella. So Atlanticism goes beyond just being a concept, a military concept, but rather it's a way of life. By stark juxtaposition, Eurasianism seeks to upend the rules-based established international order via a discourse to do with multipolar worlds. Now, when we go further into Eurasianism, what we see is a very different idea of what a way of life should be. I mean, just look at China, one of the main proponents of Eurasianism, where social credit is utilized as a whip on the populace. We can look at Russia, where the opposition at best is theater and at worst is effectively eliminated. Therefore, when we look at these two theories, these political theories, but rather these two doctrines, Atlanticism and Eurasianism, we are on one side of this coin. I, as an Atlanticist, very much see that the defense of Atlanticism is the third war that we'll have to fight as we approach the next few decades.
Alp, before we launch into our discussion on Atlanticism and Eurasianism, let's just step back for a moment and talk about Sweden's accession to NATO this past week. In previous episodes, we've talked about Sweden, NATO, Turkey. Give us the overview wrap-up of Sweden's accession to NATO and how they got there.
Well, Jim, you know, we spoke briefly earlier, and I very much agree with the concept here. One of the main aspects, which is quite imperative to identify with regard to Turkey permitting Sweden to join the alliance, is the fact that Turkey's security concerns were addressed. We have to be, within the NATO alliance, very much privy to the fact that we have local threats to our security. And the threat against one of those partner nations should be the threat against all of them. Mm-hmm. There should be no differences in semantics whether these are organizations, illegal organizations, targeting the UK, targeting the US, targeting Turkey, or targeting Sweden. And therefore, I believe that we are moving towards a more principled ascension to NATO via Sweden's entry. And moreover, with Sweden's entry, we are now able to ensure complete security in the Baltic Sea. Now, that is the most crucial part. When we look at the concerns that could arise in the Baltic Sea, Kaliningrad is the main one. Now, the Russians have sought to exploit that repeatedly during the conflict in Ukraine, But with the entry of Sweden, there is now a de facto NATO sea in the Baltic. Mm-hmm. This strengthens us, it aids us, and in line with our discussion, it ensures that Atlanticism is very much a global doctrine that seeks to be adopted by many nations, as it was in the 50s, as it is today in 2024.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that overview, because we've been following this issue of Sweden getting into NATO, and Turkey had its legitimate concerns about Sweden's application. Those security concerns have now been addressed, and so now NATO numbers 33 countries, so thank you for that explanation. Now let's come back to today's topic, and you've given us a very clear definition of Atlanticism. Let's move on to Eurasianism, because we have to remember that Russia, of course, is the largest country in the world. It spans 11 time zones. Of course, during Tsarist times, it expanded from Poland to Japan. Still does expand within that vast, vast territory of 11 time zones. Give us a sense of Russia's view of the world, particularly in terms of how Russia historically has governed itself under the Tsars, under totalitarian communism, and today under Putinism. Give us a sense of that authoritarian tradition of Russian governance, and also very much the same in China. Let's talk about Eurasianism and how that very different governance tradition is still the underpinning of how Russia and China view the world and govern themselves.
Interestingly, Jim, Putin's rule is akin to a Tsarist rule, more so than that of a Stark communist rule. Now, the Russian identity itself has flirted in between seeing itself as Western and seeing itself as Eastern, especially with regard to how it sees itself and its place in the world. Tsarist Russia had a definitive view concerning expansionism with regard to, as you've mentioned, Japan, but also being accepted as a European empire for many of the years that it continued to rule. Now, when we look at the communist period, all of the periods when it comes to rule, from secretary to secretary, it involves a different persona, whether we're looking at Brezhnev, whether we're looking at Khrushchev. The communist period for Putin is more of a reference point than it is a way in which he prefers to rule. When we look at today's Russia, when people look at Russia, they look at it from a homogeneous perspective. Russia is ruled by the perspective of institutions with a czar on top. Many of these institutions have differing views about the world and also what Russia should be doing with regard to its actions in juxtaposition to other institutions. For example, when we look at GRU has military intelligence, has a completely different global perspective than the FSB. The same way the FSB has a completely different worldview to the central intelligence agencies of the Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. Now, when we look at this from how Russia is governed, in reality, Putin has to balance many of these institutions in order to ensure, in one way, shape, or form, that Russia appears united from an institutional perspective to the outside world. Internally, Putin's sole desire is to ensure that those that he himself made powerful, whether by capital, whether by political means, do not seek to outmaneuver him domestically. We spoke about this before, and we almost foreshadowed the event. And so at the time, the rise of Wagner, and then Wagner's attempt at trying to take the throne, which was put down, is pretty much a prime example of the various factions that exist within the Russian Federation today. Mm-hmm. And Putin's sole desire for the external world is for other countries, unaligned countries, to see it, Eurasianism, its version of Eurasianism, as the ideology that they should align with. Mm-hmm. And this isn't solely about ideology. What comes with this is economic aspects to do with working with Russia. It comes with aligning their militaries closer to the Russian Federation. More importantly, it involves using these nations or these groups as proxies against us, mm-hmm. against Atlanticists, against NATO, against the US. And so when we look at this collectively, Eurasianism, whether we're looking at this from the perspective of Putin's eyes, or whether we're looking at this from a perspective of Russia seeking to leverage itself overseas, it is a foe to us on the geopolitical stage. When we look at China, China very much seeks to see itself as a globally connected trading partner. What China has actually been doing is gouging on prices since the pandemic, because it's realized that in many categories, economic categories, it holds a principal position. Now, to counter China, we have to realize that we're not facing the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. The Soviet Union was very much an economically isolated superpower in its own right, whilst China, the People's Republic of China, is a globally connected superpower that we have to challenge in many, many different ways. When we're looking at ensuring that China is contained, we have to also realize that there are flashpoints, whether this is Taiwan, whether these are CIS countries, which formerly were under the influence of the Russian Federation, which are now closer to the People's Republic of China. China's weaknesses come from the fact of ethnic division within their own country. When we look at, or when we examine the Uyghurs and their plight with the genocide that's been occurring there, this is an aspect that Atlanticists, the US, the Turkish Republic, many nations have ensured that they've been defending this case against China. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't simply end there. China's desire is to undermine national states. And to challenge it, we have to strengthen the Asian countries, the Pacific countries specifically, in order to ensure that China is contained not just in the theaters that it operates in, be that in Africa or even in certain parts of Europe, but also in its own vicinity at its own borders.
Mm-hmm. Let's come back to Russia for a minute. Of course, the Ukrainian war has been in full swing for over 2 years now. And on so many occasions, when Putin makes a certain strategic move in Ukraine, when he gives these speeches, these wild speeches referring to nuclear weapons, many of us, most of us, I think, in the West, scratch our heads and say, what is he thinking? What is the basis of this philosophy? Is he, we've even questioned his sanity with some of these moves and some of these statements, in particular with regard to threatening the use of nuclear weapons. Now, we've become somewhat familiar here in the United States with a Russian philosopher by the name of Alexander Dugin, D-U-G-I-N. And he is sometimes referred to as Putin's brain. I don't know that I'd go that far, but he is a philosopher who has a historic view of Russia and of Russian society and Russian governance. He seems to be part of the philosophical underpinning of Putin's view of the world, Putin's view of Ukraine, Putin's view of NATO, and Putin's paranoia with regard to how Russia's perceived in the world. Tell us a little bit about Alexander Dugin, because by talking about him, that will kind of inform us about why Putin says and does some of the things that he does.
The witch doctor shaman of Moscow, Jim. That would be the best description for Alexander Dugin. Alexander Dugin has spent his life essentially navigating the waters between being entirely irrelevant and being entirely crucial to those that support Eurasianism. What he sought to do was to create an ideology which would be simple enough for the rank and file of, initially, the Russian Federation, as in state employees, to understand, and at the same time have enough credence for him to export overseas. Now, to us, he's a foe. He's a threat. Yes, we do kid around about him, but he is a serious threat to us. There are various reasons why. Alexander Dugin's ideology, as much as he paints a picture of a different world that's possible, is a world of chaos. If anyone has studied some of the aspects of his work, it revolves around the position of perpetual revolution, mm-hmm. perpetual chaos. Therefore, his underpinning is the fact that Alexander Dugin initially may have started as someone who had, which I completely disagree with, and everyone around me does, an original idea for himself. Somewhere along the line, I believe that the Russian Federation became involved in his own ideology, and it's now morphed into something which is even out of his own control. So much so that the Eurasianism that supposedly Alexander Dugin himself coined is now fronted by the People's Republic of China, and they're not referencing him in the actions that they're doing. Mm-hmm. They have a different approach. They have a different understanding to Eurasianism. Therefore, we have to see the threat posed by Dugin, but at the same time, we have to realize that Atlanticism far outweighs any ideology coined by this shaman of high-end restaurants in southern Moscow. This perspective, as in of Atlanticism, is an aspect which is shared by the wealthiest countries in the world, the most secure countries in the world. It has brought about the most important strategic military alliance that has been known to man and continues to this day, NATO. And very much, when we're talking about nuclear aspects, this discourse is part of Russia's, or rather Putin's, nuclear posturing. Nuclear posturing is the fact that the Russian Federation, especially since the onset of the war in Ukraine, has started to utilize the literature and the semantics of nuclear posturing without having the intention, obviously, to use it. Now, the reason is many countries, such as the US, have an extensive history of remembering aspects to do with the Soviet Union and various aspects that come with the nuclear posturing that occurred then. In fact, it wasn't really posturing. It was very much a significant threat to the world. Mm-hmm. The Russians seek to capitalize on this. However, they have to realize that our nuclear arsenal, as the Allied Community of Nations, is more modern, is more extensive, has a wider ranging alliance network, meaning that we have a larger strategic net to counter the Russian Federation's nuclear arsenal. And finally, more to the point, with hypersonic technology now being imperative when it comes to future deployment of tactical nuclear weapons, we are on the front foot of hypersonic weapons, of hypersonic missiles. Therefore, in the future, it's pretty much set in stone that we will be the more powerful of the two, of the three, if you count China in this context, with their nuclear weapons, but the discourse is coming at least on a regional level from Russia, to ensure the security of the world as we've done so for many, many decades.
Let's step back for a moment and talk about institutionalizing this concept of Eurasianism and also the alternate reality of authoritarianism as a form of government as opposed to Western liberal democracy. We've seen China, Russia, Iran, for instance, which are the three of the largest countries on the Asian landmass. We've seen the three of them, of course, come together and try to expand that group called the BRICS, which was originally coined by an analyst at Goldman Sachs for back in the heady days of the early 2000s, when all of those countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, were enjoying faster economic growth rates. That's how the BRICS, as I recall, was first coined. China and Russia have taken that term and are trying to create a political bloc, which has as its underpinning the concept of Eurasianism versus Atlanticism, the concept of, while they may not call it authoritarian rule, it is all of them, many of them have authoritarian rule. And in their most recent meeting, they tried to expand the group to include countries like Iran, Saudi Arabia. Now, we have to say that, of course, Brazil is a democracy. It is not an autocracy. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it is part of this group, somewhat aligns itself to it. South Africa, I'd have to put a question mark around what kind of government South Africa has. Nominally, perhaps a democracy, but at the end of the day, I'll put a question mark there. But again, we see this morphing of this economic loose grouping that was coined by Goldman Sachs into something a little more concrete, the BRIC countries. Talk to us about this coalescing of this group coming together, which have at their core the Eurasian view of the world, authoritarian governments, a rejection of modernity, a rejection of liberal Western concepts of the rule of law. Talk to us about this evolving group, the BRICS, that seem to be on a, I don't want to say a crash course, but who are offering an alternate view of the world, if you will, to other countries in Africa, in Asia, and Latin America.
Yeah, I'm quite intrigued to understand, since the formation of the BRIC so-called alliance, which major economic indicators can be correlated to that nation's participation within BRICS. You know, to me, it started as though it was a nascent economic association mm-hmm. between various countries which had some form of either similar demographics, or they could leverage on each other for various resources. That then morphed into some form of, and again, yes, you're right, Brazil could be excluded on this matter, but the majority do fall under it. Then this evolved into some type of understanding about how to govern mm-hmm. mutually, as in all of them would look the other way on their forms of governance. That then turned into, you know, with the definition of authoritarianism, you know, it's when it comes to the BRIC nations, it's very much a fact of simply seeking to extend rule. When we look at authoritarianism, the definition historically is very different to the one we have today. Mm. In today's world, very much to do with, let's say, some of the nations that we've just mentioned with regard to BRICS, it's to do with the state having supreme control over the political system. That is the form of authoritarianism that we see, whether that's in Tehran, whether that's being, well, exported and executed by Russia, and very much the case in China. Therefore, this evolution, if we look at the events that preceded it, has come about via the events that have taken place in those countries. I mean, if we look at how BRICS has now become a more concise and closed-ended, even if we ignore some of the new joiners, with mm-hmm. regard to demand, a closed-ended organization, it's very much correlated to the events that have occurred. I mean, you've had mass protests in Iran over the last decade. You've had mass protests it's been a while, but in Russia over the last 10 years, you've had China moving from seeking to be part of the global economic order to seeking to upend the global mm-hmm. economic and social order. So I think what's happened is it's almost as though, you know, these three have found each other in this maze that they themselves have created. And so instead of going down the path of, you know, evolving their political systems, developing their forms of governance, building ties with the rest of the world, they have decided to become our foes. Now, this is a voluntary desire. You know, events may precede you to take a position, but your intent is very much your intent. Therefore, BRICS, in my opinion, when it comes to economics, is a smoke show. And in reality, it's an understanding for many of the countries that are involved that they will have the opportunity to have their forms of governance overlooked and very much still be part of an alliance, if you can call it that in inverted commas, regardless of whether they're going to implement reforms or seek to further align themselves with us in the West.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right. It's so at this point, we have the Eurasianism philosophy, if you will, mm-hmm. we now have a grouping of countries which are aligned to Eurasian or to some aspects of Eurasianism, namely mm-hmm. the BRICS. You're absolutely right. We see at every turn China and Russia looking to tear down elements of the mm-hmm. the Western alliance, the Atlanticist alliance. For instance, the hegemony of the dollar. And of course, Russia has really suffered as a result of these sanctions, but Russia and China both together recognize the overwhelming strength and economic power of the West, as demonstrated through these sanctions. So there's no doubt about it, this grouping that's coming together, which has as its common thread authoritarian forms of government, but they don't seem to have they don't have a common currency. They don't have common economic policies. They don't have common defense policies. And in fact, if we step back for a minute, the two key members of that group, the BRICS group, Russia and China, of course, they fought a border war in 1969. There are Chinese who, remembering their history, remember that huge swaths of Eastern Russia, Siberia, were seized by Tsarist interests during the 18th and 19th centuries. And China, there are still Chinese historians who argue that those territories should be given back to China. So that relationship between Russia and China, at best, is a testy one and is not built on solid foundations. So, you know, it seems to me this alternate view of the world, if the BRICS are going out and trying to sell this alternate view of the world to the 50-plus countries in Africa, and they are, it would seem to me that that group is not on a sound footing. It's not on a sound footing as having members who have something more than authoritarian, repressive forms of government in common.
You see, Jim, when it comes to Eurasianism is a necessity for countries that govern themselves in that way, whilst Atlanticism is a virtue. And I think that is the main differential here. Many of the countries that have aligned themselves to Eurasianism have done so because of the ways that they've governed their people, mm-hmm. because of the laws that they've passed, because of the positioning they have in the world. Whether they're defined as pariahs or whether they're defined as rogue states, it is a definition that's been placed on them. And with that, they have decided not to bring themselves out of that metaphorical hole, but rather go further in and consolidate upon it. Whilst Atlanticism is about being a principled nation, having a place in the world, defending the rules-based international order, defending our way of life, our mutual way of life within NATO. NATO is not just a military alliance. It's very much an alliance that secures our shape, our way and shape of life within the respective nations that we live in. And when we look at, you know, aspects where countries and BRICS differ, I mean, I hardly doubt that the many of the ruling classes of the nations within BRICS are holding local currency or their respective partner currencies as their personal holdings.
Yes.
You know, I think that's where the critical part is. I mean, you know, when you know, the USD is still king. And so I think that is the crucial aspect here. Mm-hmm. You have got nations, some of the most overtly active nations in countering our efforts to secure the world, who have all come together, and they still haven't been able to unseat the USD when it comes to its place. And once again, I'm emphasizing here, its place within the economies of developed nations. Therefore, it's not an aspect that concerns me with regard to where we sit within NATO. The only aspect that concerns me is the fact that non-aligned nations who could be future potential partners for the West, whether this is in Central Asia, whether this is in Africa, Latin America, or the Pacific for that matter, if they fall into the hands of Eurasianism, it's going to be rather difficult to get them out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we should promote Atlanticism by way of defense transactions, security cooperation, bringing them into associations, our own military associations. We have, as NATO, many agreements in place with other regions in the world where we work with cooperating with other countries which may not be within the peripheral that NATO is meant to secure, but there's still critical regions, whether that's in the Middle East, whether that's in Asia, elsewhere. And when we look at the world today, we have to realize that many of these non-aligned countries are right now at the cusp of the fight between Atlanticism and Eurasianism. And that's where both of these worlds will collide.
Mm-hmm. Well, Alp, of course, the big struggle between Atlanticism and Eurasianism for the last 2 years has been on the battlefield in Ukraine, where we have Russia on the one hand trying to impose its view of authoritarian governance and Eurasianism on Ukraine, and Ukraine turning to the West, looking to NATO, looking to the EU, looking to the United States for support and becoming more of a liberal democracy. Where do we stand at this point in terms of that struggle? Because it looks that there have been signs that Ukraine has been a little bit on the back foot of late. Give us a brief overview of where we stand in that struggle between Eurasianism and Atlanticism, Russia and Ukraine.
I believe Ukraine has been at the forefront of fighting for Atlanticism for the duration of this war, even prior to this conflict. I mean, you know, many people forget that Crimea occurred years ago, mm-hmm. and that was the first attempt at the Russians significantly seeking to undermine the international order. When it comes to the type of country that Ukraine has become, it has now gone from being a capable wartime economy, wartime nation, and it's become a country that can function, that can operate at state institutions, and at the same time fight a very significant conflict against a nation that is seen as a regional power. So when we're looking at Ukraine, I am filled with confidence with regard to their battle abilities. I very much admire the fact that despite them having very little time to train in the defense systems that we've provisioned to them, they have become swiftly adept at utilizing them against the Russians. And when it comes to Atlanticism as a whole, and with regard to where we are within the greater scheme of the conflict, the Ukrainians, then rather than being on the back foot, they are now in a position where they can seriously define the outcome of the war. Now, when we look at what's been happening, obviously, in the US with regard to spending for Ukraine, there is actually a bipartisan opinion amongst both senators and the House, amongst both parties. It may not be voiced very often, but if any of your listeners spend a lot of time in Washington privately, you know, the Republicans are fully on board as well. So in terms of our support, we're giving them our support. We should be giving them more, but we are absolutely there to defend them against this aggressor nation. And with regard to the specific point we're in reference to the campaign, Ukraine is seeking to utilize its resources in the best way possible. Therefore, at times, if they're holding, it's to ensure that that region is secure prior to moving on to other battlefields, because it realizes that it's in a conflict which, although we are supporting them as NATO, as the US, as Ukraine's allies, at the end of the day, on the ground, it's the Ukrainian forces that are leading a valiant campaign against the Russian Federation.
Mm-hmm. Alp, in the remaining few moments of the podcast, what are your closing thoughts about Atlanticism and Eurasianism? I think you've given our listeners today a great historic overview of how the two isms arose, how they're currently on the battlefield duking it out, if you will, in Ukraine. What are your closing thoughts about these two isms?
You know, some time ago, I was in a gathering. And there was a Eurasianist there. And I asked him, where did you send your kids for their education? He said, well, I sent them to the US. Mm-hmm. I said, so, you know, which countries do you travel to? Well, you know, I go to Cannes, I go here, I go there. And the list goes on and on. I said, you're not a Eurasianist. I said, this is a farce. I mean, for me to consider you as a serious ideology, you have to have something to adhere to. And when I looked at how hollow that person's existence was, and this was someone, you know, obviously in a critical position, mm-hmm. you know, for me it was a farce. And you know, the counter being that I am, you know, very much an advocate of Atlanticism, I said, well, I live my life by it. So I think when we look at Atlanticism and Eurasianism, away simply from the definitions, we simply have to look at our lives. How do we want our children to grow up? Mm-hmm. How do we want to live? How do we imagine a safe and secure, prosperous world, a world where ambition is rewarded, kleptocracy is clamped down upon? And moreover, when we look at nations which are our allies, we realize that any threat that opposes them can be met by our force and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So I think that the more we look internally, the more we see that Atlanticism is very much the way of life that has not only secured our lives, but many of the generations prior to us.
Mm-hmm. Very well said, Alp. And Alp, what new projects are you working on at this point?
So we are representing U.S. defense companies in regions where we feel Atlanticism, and you know, we're quite, as you can imagine, we're quite punchy on the topic, where we feel Atlanticism must be defended or mm-hmm. must be promoted. And so when you have, and I've been very privileged in my life to, when you have the ability to couple your worldview with your execution capabilities, what you have is a mission. And, you know, we have been extremely capable on this topic. And secondly, we have been very much adherents to this topic. Therefore, when you are a principled actor, when it comes to securing Atlanticism in any way, shape or form, be that commercially, be that geopolitically, be that transactionally, it doesn't matter. When you are contributing to this enormous mission that all of us, all of your listeners, yourself included, all of us are contributing to within our own lives, what we are doing on a grander scale is contributing to global security. And I think there's no better mission for all of us in the world we live in, where every day brings on new chaos in parts of the world where civilians are utterly massacred by aggressor states. This is our mission, and the more we contribute to it by simply being the Atlanticists that we are in our daily lives, the better a world will leave to our descendants henceforth.
And Alp, how can our listeners contact you?
So the best way to contact myself, one of the ways is obviously through our corporate channels, through the company. The other way is obviously through my agents, which is VPR. And finally, it's also to do with the Atlantic Council. So I can be reached by the Atlantic Council also. And all of these, I'm regularly contacted by whether it's newspapers, organizations, governments, corporations. So I'm always one way, shape or form, no matter what the time zone is, always up. But moreover, and I'm sure many of your listeners are reading some of the major press publications in the world, if anyone's picking up Newsweek, the Daily Express, the Daily Mail, and many, many, the Washington Examiner, and many, many more, they'll regularly find my work, which is in the form of op-eds and interviews. And as they'll see, I very much bring my persona, my beliefs, into my expertise, and align myself to the quest for Atlanticism and execute this in form by my daily deeds.
Mm-hmm. And Alp, what is your X handle?
My X handle, as I always say in the most clandestine way, is my first name, surname put together. And so in that way, I can be reached. But for many, many corporate matters, media matters, interview matters, my media team can be reached on the three channels that I've mentioned just before.
Okay. I'm simply going to restate the X handle. It's at ALPSEVIMLISOY, at Alp Savimlisoy. And again, Alp, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Jim. As always, hopefully the next time I'll be flying into Pebble Beach. So we'll do it like this. Every time I'm flying in, we'll do an interview, and then every time I've returned back, we'll have the redux.
We will look forward to it. And for our listeners, today's episode is number 507. Listen to us on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms with listeners in 60 countries. FeedSpot recognizes us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.